Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 5th, 2010. The sandwich generation is feeling a particular squeeze in this recession. In a moment, we'll hear about some options for those caught in the middle. Here's a dilemma for those caught between a lousy economy and the Fed.
It is tough to see that you're only getting, you know, 0.01% in your money market account or something like that right now. You know, that's only a dollar for every $10,000 invested.
Savers with no interest. And meet Haley Taylor, part job counselor, part reality TV star.
Show me that you are fit for thinking about going into work, because at this moment I don't see that. And that's just displayed it to me.
She is the fairy job mother, and we'll hear about her a little later on Marketplace Money. But first, one out of every eight Americans aged 40 to 60 is both raising a child and caring for an aging parent. It's a startling number that's expected to get bigger and bigger as baby boomers reach retirement age and find they haven't saved enough. Those in the middle have been dubbed the sandwich generation, and they're the focus of a special section in this weekend's New York Times. In a moment, we'll talk with the Your Money columnist, Ron Lieber, about their findings. But first, let's hear from someone who currently resides in the sandwich.
My name is Adrienne Quill. I'm a homemaker, and I live in Matamidi, Minnesota, which is a suburb of St. Paul. My parents are 89 and 82 years old. They live in Indianapolis, Indiana. I have two sons. Murphy's in kindergarten this year. About a year ago, we had our second son. My father is still living independently, but does need some help. I also check in on my mother over at the assisted living facility. I do feel myself pulled in two directions. My parents were both very good to my sister and me, and you know, of course, my sons need a mother. I am responsible simply because they gave us so much, and my father is still giving us so much. And I feel that this is the least I can do for him. I think at some point we're going to have to consider a move, just so I can be more available to them.
Ron Lieber, that just sums up the story.
It does, doesn't it? And then multiply that by 5 million, 10 million, however many people are that are out there in their 40s or 50s who have aging parents who may be running out of money, and kids getting ready for college or coming out of college who are themselves having trouble sort of launching themselves. And you get a sense of how many people who are out there.
Certainly this isn't a new phenomenon, though. I mean, we've had generations like this, you know, for time immemorial. Why has it become such an issue?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it's longevity. When people live longer, they need more care. They might be in a nursing home longer. But the other thing we're dealing with is, you know, yet another impact of the economic environment, right? If people are in a situation, say, you know, the oldest generation, you know, the top of the sandwich, so to speak, if they're in a situation where their resources have been depleted or their investment portfolios are not what they once were, then that becomes an issue. Then you look at the younger generation. The younger generation is going to college, and colleges are increasingly expensive, right? So people are coming out with higher levels of student loan debt, and now they're graduating into an economy that is not ready to offer them jobs that will allow them to be financially independent. And meanwhile, these grown-ups in their 40s and 50s are kind of in the middle of all this, and they too have unstable employment at just the moment they were hoping to kind of ramp up their retirement saving. So the things that are going on with the economy affect all three of these generations. And that, on top of increased longevity, makes the squeeze inside of the sandwich that much more difficult to deal with than it might have been 10 or 20 or 30 years ago.
So how do you get started on that conversation? How do you even know that it's an appropriate one to have? And who do you have it with?
Well, it's tricky, but, you know, you have to start with your parents. You know, have they planned for their own long-term care? And if they haven't, how might a stay in a nursing home at $75,000 or $100,000 a year deplete their assets.
And how do you, if you are a member of that sandwich group, how do you prepare for it?
It's a really tricky thing, Tess. I mean, you have to hope that your employment situation, at least, is stable enough that, you know, you can bear it. And I think the first thing you have to do is, you know, rather than sacrificing financially yourself, I mean, you have to think carefully about what are all of the things that you can do, you know, with your parents and your parents' assets that might allow them to stretch further than you think they would. I mean, one of the things we tried to do in our special section was sort of talk about some of the products and services that are out there and consider, you know, which ones could potentially be more useful in the coming years and which ones are a little more uncertain.
Well, let's talk about a couple of specifics there. I know that you in particular wrote about long-term care insurance, and boy, do we get a lot of questions about that here. People just don't really understand when they're supposed to start thinking about that and really what it's going to cost them.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, first of all, I suppose we should define the term. You know, a lot of people out there, Tess, think that Medicare is going to cover, you know, a five-year stay in a nursing home
right.
or, you know, 2 hours of assistance from a home health care aide. And the fact is that it's not going to.
Mm-hmm.
And so long-term care insurance is designed to pay a certain amount or even up to all of the amount for your stay in a nursing home or for your move to an assisted living facility. That's what it is for.
But of course, people are scared to buy it because they're worried about having claims denied or decades of paying premiums that they then don't use.
Right. I mean, it turns out that there are at least, you know, 9 or 10 sort of mental hurdles that people attempt to clear before they even shop for long-term care insurance. It's an enormously complicated product. But just sort of getting to the decision that, yes, I do, in fact, need long-term care insurance, it involves, you know, sort of talking yourself out of all sorts of things from, you know, assuming that you can pay for the whole thing by yourself without insurance to, you know, assuming, you know, your kids are going to take care of you physically or financially. All these things that people sort of talk themselves into, but they may not always be right about them.
So these are the types of things that, I mean, obviously the people in the sandwich generation need to start thinking about as they age. But is this also something that you talk about with your parents as products for them to keep the problem from happening in the first place?
Absolutely. Some forward-thinking parents, you know, purchase long-term care insurance, say, for themselves as an act of love towards their kids because they don't want their kids to have to take care of them. But if your parents have not brought this up, it's certainly well within your right as a member of that family to, you know, raise it with your parents and to say, look, you know, do we have a plan for this? Not talking about it is a bad idea for everybody.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, and their special section about the sandwich generation is out, and we've got a link to that on our website. Ron, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this is part of a new partnership with the New York Times. We'll be having more over the coming weeks. Next week, we'll hear about another issue facing the sandwich generation. When so much of the family finances are going toward care for aging parents, what happens to the kids' inheritance? And now we're going to take some of your money questions. With me this week is Liz Pilliam-Weston, personal finance columnist for MSN Money. Welcome back, Liz.
Thank you, Tess.
So we're going to try something a little different this week, tackle questions throughout the show. So let's start with Sarah from Sparks, Maryland. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
How do you listen to the show there?
Oh, I listen to it on my local radio station on WYPR.
Wonderful. And what do you do?
I'm a photojournalist.
Are you a feature photojournalist?
I sort of do a little bit of everything. I photograph folks in the community, do a little bit of politics, was obviously really busy with the election and kind
right.
of get to meet the community wackadoos. So it's a lot of fun.
That's the best part of being a journalist, right?
That's
especially
right.
a political journalist.
That's the best
journalist.
Part of being the journalist.
So what was your favorite wackadoo this week?
Oh, gosh. You know, there weren't a lot of wackadoos this week, but I really think I should start a blog. I've had some very interesting moments.
So what can we help you out with?
Well, I actually had a question. My husband and I are preparing to buy our first home. We started to look at things like our debt-to-income ratio.
Right.
And my mother is a wonderful human being who, when I was going to college, offered to pay for my student loans and to put me through school. But it became a problem because she thought she was doing me a favor by putting all the student loans in my name. She thought it would help me build credit, which it did. But now the loan payments are pretty high and actually affect what we can qualify for. So I was wondering if there was anything that we could do to actually have those loans taken out of my name so that it wouldn't impact our ability to qualify for a home.
Can I ask you what kind of money we're talking about?
The loans are about $60,000 right now.
Sarah, let me ask you, what kind of term are you paying this back on? Is it 10-year, 20-year, 30-year?
I believe it's a 20-year.
Okay. And are these all federal loans, or do you have some private loans in there, too?
They're all federal.
Well, I do have some suggestions.
Okay. So, again, the question here really is whether she can somehow move those loans over to her mother?
Right. And she can't. Is your mother willing to make that sizable gift and just pay them off for you, or is that not possible?
I don't think that that's possible at this point.
Okay. Does she have equity in her home?
Yes.
Because that's an option. Now, it does put her home at risk, so you want to make absolutely sure that she can make these payments.
I see.
Liz, how is student loan debt treated any different, say, when you're looking for a mortgage than the credit card debt is treated, or is it all just plain loan to value?
Well, you actually have some flexibility with federal student loans that you might not with other forms of debt. Like with a credit card, it's typically the minimum payment that's counted against you.
Hmm.
With a federal student loan, you have all these options. I mean, you could put it on deferment or forbearance so that it, you know, technically wouldn't count. It would still be part of your credit score, but generally student loans are a positive influence.
Oh.
It's kind of playing games with debt to do that, to say that, you know, you're in forbearance on this, so it doesn't get counted. So not something I'd necessarily recommend. But you could also, I think with $60,000, you could stretch out the term to 30 years, which would reduce the amount of payment that's counted against you. If you had a low income, you could go income-based. So there's a lot of different ways to kind of shuffle the deck to make that debt look smaller than it actually is.
Do either of those sound like possible options, either refinancing into a 30-year loan for – sounds like a mortgage – for your student loan, or would you potentially qualify for a low-income exemption?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, my mother and I would have to talk about it, but I think that either of those might be a possibility that we could discuss.
All right, Sarah. Well, congratulations in advance and good luck.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And stay tuned for more of your questions later in the show. If our conversation reminded you of a question you'd like to ask, go to marketplace.org and send us a note through the Getting Personal link, or give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. I got a note from our show producer this week that we were doing a story on QE2. What? Queen? The boat? Turns out she was using the new shorthand for something the Federal Reserve did this week. It's the second round of something called quantitative easing. See? QE2. We are such money geeks. The Fed is pushing $600 billion into the economy to drive long-term interest rates down, make borrowing cheaper, and get us to spend more. But that is the very last thing the nation's savers need right now. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Ever since the financial crisis hit, the Fed's been on a relentless campaign to drive down interest rates and shock the economy back to life. That's one reason you can get a 30-year mortgage at 4% interest. The downside, you can hardly earn any interest when you deposit money at the bank. Ben Gilbert's a certified financial planner at Silver Oak Advisory Group in Portland, Oregon.
From 1993 to 2008, the average one-year CD was returning just over 4.5%. Returns right now for CDs, a one-year CD is less than 1% usually.
So what does that really mean? Well, let's say you had a $10,000 CD in the mid-2000s. It may have paid $450 in interest a year. Now it's paying $75 or less. Your money's safe, says Gilbert. These are low-risk cash investments, often FDIC guaranteed, where the principal's not at risk and it's available when you need it.
But it is tough to see that you're only getting, you know, 0.01% in your money market account, in your Schwab account or something like that right now. You know, that's only a dollar for every $10,000 invested.
One of the things that we teach our students is the magic of compound interest.
Catherine Mann is a professor at Brandeis University and a former Fed economist. And the magic she's talking about, that's when your interest is plowed back into your savings account, adding to the principal, which then generates even more interest, Over time, it can really add up.
It's very difficult to teach that right now. There's not a lot of magic because interest rates are so low.
Mann teaches finance to 20 and 30-somethings who have years of saving ahead of them. It's actually their parents and grandparents who are suffering most now. Washington University economist Steve Fazzari explains.
If you are a retired person, risk-averse, doesn't have money in the stock market, or trying to finance your retirement by, say, certificates of deposit, very safe assets, the returns you've been getting for the last several years have been historically low.
Claudine Anderson of Framingham, Massachusetts, sees the result of this every month in her financial statements. When the recession hit, she and her husband were on the cusp of retirement. Both lost their jobs.
I'm only 62. My husband's 63, so that last 4 or 5 years were really going to get us set.
Now they're cutting back on groceries, clothing, health care. The interest they earn in their retirement account is way down, and another $30,000 they've put away is stuck in a low-interest savings account.
And that's also killing us because it's pennies. With the way that the Fed is doing the magic stuff that they're doing, we're losing money every day.
That's not really the magic the Fed is looking for, but the central bank does want people to stop socking away so much money and spend more so the economy can grow. Catherine Mann at Brandeis says this ends up punishing those who are trying to do the right thing.
The people who now are getting religion, so to speak, and saying, you know, I really need to work within my means. I need to save a little bit more. The current very low interest rates make it very unattractive to do that.
Unattractive enough, says financial planner Ben Gilbert, to make some people look outside traditional cash investments.
The trend lately at least seems to be maybe putting them in emerging market bonds or higher yield bonds, traditionally called junk bonds. And in fact, those are all historically have been very risky, very volatile relative to cash.
Good afternoon, Silver Oak Advisory Group. May I ask who's calling?
Gilbert tells his clients they may be able to find slightly higher returns on bank deposits by shopping online, but they shouldn't divert their cash into riskier investments because it may not be there when they need it. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
People will do just about anything to save a buck, right? You'd think so. But researchers at the California Institute of Technology recently found that if you can see and feel a product, you'll actually pay more for it, a lot more. Which prompts us to ask.
Let me start with question number one. What the hell were you thinking?
What were you thinking? Our occasional look at why we do what we do with our money. So here was my tough assignment to illustrate the Caltech findings. Have lunch, and more importantly, dessert, with the lead researcher, neuroeconomist Dr. Antonio Rangel. He hails originally from Spain, so tune your ear for the accent. Rangel studies why some of us have more self-control than others in both eating and spending. After a quick lunch at Caltech's Athenaeum restaurant, we got to the sweet part.
Hi, would you like any dessert today?
Yeah, so what do you have here?
We have a lemon goat cheese cheesecake with blueberries, warm Maracaibo cake with vanilla bean ice cream, and a stone fruit crisp with cherry ice cream.
I think I'd actually go with the lemon cheesecake.
Yep, very good.
I never say no to chocolate, especially when it's in front of me, and I really hope my wife is not listening.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Tell us why we're here for the dessert tray.
Well, we're trying to illustrate the practical implications of a study that we recently did, which tried to investigate if the way goods are presented to the consumer changes the value, their willingness to pay for those goods. We did a very simple experiment first, which is we brought hungry Caltech undergraduates to the laboratory. We gave them some money that they could either keep or use to purchase foods to eat from us. Or we actually put a tray in front of them that looked just like the picture, but it was in front of them. And what we found was very surprising to us, that people were willing to pay the same amount for the text and the picture condition, but they were willing to pay about 50% more when the real food was in front of them.
50%?
50% more, which if you are trying to sell food to people and you know how tight profit margins are, it's not a trivial number.
So then, by that logic, I would be willing to pay more for this lemon cheesecake because it's put in front of me than I would if I just ordered it off the menu?
That's what our experiment suggests, yes.
So when he brought the tray around, I mean, my reaction was, I'm actually
not that hungry, and probably if I were reading off a menu, I don't know that I would have ordered dessert. But boy, you bring it around and I get a good look at it. I want that.
There is a very well documented phenomenon. Basically, when these very appetitive things are in front of us, we tend to assign higher value to them, and that leads to higher consumption of desserts, perhaps of purchases on brick-and-mortar stores, etc.
Then is it possible to make a connection between this willingness to pay more for something that I can see and touch here in a retail environment?
I think if I had to draw a general lesson, personal for me, from these things, culturally we tend to think that we know what we like and we go to the store and we decide whether it's worth the price or not, end of the story. What all of these experiments show is that there are a lot of variables going on at the time of decision, some controlled by the store and some just incidental, that affect at the time of that decision how much value you assign to those things and whether or not you purchase the thing. And if those things go in a particular way, you may find yourself purchasing something that then you never enjoy or consume as much as you thought.
Or you pay too much for
it. Or you pay too much for. Or if you go to a store and they sell, you go to, I don't know, Tiffany's or a fancy jewelry store, mm-hmm. and the stuff that they're selling is behind a counter versus not, that may matter. Let me emphasize, we haven't done the study at those levels of pricing, but that's where the study's pointing to.
Yeah, and I don't think that Tiffany's is going to put any of its product out from behind the counter.
Well, not that I shop there, but my impression is that when you go to many high-end stores where they are concerned about theft, you do have someone, when you show an interest, put the things in front of you. They bring them out.
That's true.
And, of course, part of that is to get you to try them and be able to... But I'm saying, to what extent have they learned by trial and error, even if they never knew about the study, that enhances the probability of sale.
Wow. So what do you take away from this as a consumer? Is it possible to change your habits based on this kind of knowledge?
One of the most beautiful experiments in psychology that I know about were done by a professor called Walter Mischel about 20 years ago. They brought young children and they put candy in front of them. And they told them, I'm going to leave the room for 15 minutes. If you are able not to eat the candy, when I come back, I will give you twice as much. And then they measure how long the kids were able to stop from eating it. And what they found is that the kids that were successful at waiting did not look at the candy. They distracted themselves. So that is your answer.
We have now been sitting here, and you have not touched your lava cake, so... I'm going to end this interview. Dr. Rangel, thank you so much for joining us here at the Caltech Athenaeum. It's been delicious and fun.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Dr. Antonio Rangel is a neuroeconomist at the California Institute of Technology. His study was published in the American Economic Review Journal. Liz Pulliam Weston is back with us. And, you know, Liz, earlier in the show, we were talking about the sandwich generation. Mm. I think this is a concern that's coming up for more and more people. Obviously, this is because we have an aging population of baby boomers and their kids have kids.
Yeah.
So what do you think the solution is? I mean, should anyone, in this sandwich generation basically just assume that they're going to be taking care of both their parents and their kids?
I think they need to make a plan for that to happen. I've been through this with my dad, and it gets expensive really fast when your dad or your parents start to become incapacitated, because a lot of times you need to call in help.
Yeah.
And especially if you're dealing long distance, that can wind up being a lot of money. And also, a lot of people haven't prepared that well for their retirement, so you may need to kick in on a monthly basis. So even if you're not sure, or you don't actually know how your parents are situated, it might be worth setting aside some kind of fund so that you've got some money to tap. And also, it's a delicate issue, but trying to talk to them about it,
oh,
about
yeah.
what they've done for their future, really, really tough.
All right, well, let's go back to the phones. And Renato is on the line from Clemens, North Carolina. Hi, Renato.
Hey, Tess. How's it going?
Very well. How do you catch the show there in Clemens?
Well, I usually listen to the podcast, but our public stations here are WFDD and WSNC, and I listen to their stations, too.
And what do you do there in Clemens?
I work at Wake Forest University. I'm a cardiologist at the medical school.
Oh, wow. And how are your money habits?
Generally, I think pretty good. We tend to be pretty good savers. I come from an immigrant family, and my parents were very good savers, and those are the kind of things that hopefully I try to teach my kids.
How old are your kids?
I have a 13-year-old and a 9-year-old, Andreas and Olivia.
Wonderful. And so how have you approached that conversation with them? How have you taught them to be savers?
Actually, listening to a lot of your previous shows, when the kids were young, I started savings accounts for them. I did what I called a kiddie 401k, so to speak. So,
Oh, tell me about that.
So was that a matching fund?
Yeah, exactly. So I told them, whatever you put in the bank account, I'll match. Whatever you take out of the bank account, I'm going to charge you a fine. And then when you turn 18, you can keep whatever's in there, and you can do with it whatever you want.
So were you like many employers during the onset of the economic crisis where you took away the match?
Well, it's not exactly. What happened is that, you know, part of the deal was whatever money they wanted to put in. So they had to put in some of their allowance, but they can put in anything more than that they wanted. So over the years, the grandparents would give them money, and my kids kind of caught on to this. They started sticking it in the bank account. And then this past year, my son had put so much money in, I said, you know, I'm going to have to put a cap on this match. And he said,
cool.
He said, no way, Dad, that wasn't the deal.
That wasn't the deal, man.
So I'm going to have to hurt my my in-laws and my parents because they're really putting a crimp on me. And then about a few weeks ago or a month ago, we noticed his bank account hit to about $3,000.
Whoa.
I know. He's a 13-year-old. And we've been talking about, you know, with all the stuff going on, we've been talking about the markets. And he said to me, well, you know, maybe I can invest some of this money. So, and I said, all right, well, why don't you do some investigating and you decide what you want to invest it in. And that's when I got the idea to ask you all for some advice.
Yeah, well, you know, we've actually already heard in the show about how there really aren't a lot of places to park your cash right now.
Right.
Get any sort of return. It's painful for savers right now, isn't it, Liz?
It is not a good time to be a saver, just because trying to get any kind of yield is really a strain.
Right. I have a couple of goals. One, obviously, I want him not to lose all of his money. But really, for me, the ultimate goal is to teach him how to invest and how to, you know, look at things and invest responsibly and understand, right. You know, and that may be a lot for a 13-year-old, but I don't know, when do you start if you don't start now?
You know, Liz, this is a great question because our standard pat answer for adults who have this question is you need to evaluate what your risk tolerance is.
Mm-hmm.
How do you tell that to a 13-year-old who, like, loves to go skateboarding and has no concept of risk?
Right.
Well, actually, the first question is, what is your goal for the money? Because that's going to determine your timeline.
Right.
And everything else falls into place behind that. So really what he needs to do first is decide, am I going to need this money at 18?
Mm-hmm.
And if his goal is within 10 years, I would say investing in the stock market's not appropriate.
Right.
There's just too much risk of loss. If, on the other hand, your goal is to learn about the stock market,
mm-hmm.
then absolutely. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than having a share of a company and getting the annual report and realizing you're a part owner. I mean, that's a
real
thrill.
Nothing more exciting, Liz, let me tell you. You're the one who reads the annual reports, right?
Yeah, I know. It's pathetic. But the reality is it's a way to get kids to understand how the economy works.
Right.
And there's ways to do it. I mean, you could sign him up for a discount brokerage and, you know, show him how to trade. You could use ShareBuilder, something like that, to kind of get in.
Yeah, and that's what I was looking for. I wasn't, you know, we looked at the kind of the usual standard funds. And, you know, a lot of them need a $3,000 minimum, so we're just barely there. And that might be great. But I was wondering, is there something where he can invest a few hundred dollars or $1,000 and we can put some in stocks, some in bonds, some in, you know, other things, and then we can track these along and he can see where things go?
I'll put in a pitch for something that I've done for my nieces and nephews, which is, you already mentioned it, ShareBuilder.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no minimum investment, and you can actually do a dollar amount, or you can buy based on share price. But it's a great way to learn the basics. You know, you can buy any stock or any mutual fund.
And I think these are all things that, you know, I really want to get my kids doing, because even though my parents were good savers, I'm not sure that they were really that great investors.
Right.
Yeah, I really hope that this is the right thing, and that, you know, I hope that we all of a sudden don't get another crash and then get them really scared away. But I've told them we'll take good care of them now, because I expect that they're my retirement plan.
That would be the sandwich generation.
There you go.
Well, great question, Renato. Let us know what you decide to do, and we'll chat with them at some point.
Yeah, we definitely will. In fact, he's chomping at the bit. I'm going to go to ShareBuilder, and I think that's a great idea. I think we're going to do that. I'll tell you how things go as we get along.
Wonderful.
Okay, have fun.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more of your questions a little bit later in the show. Stay tuned. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. If you find yourself awake in the middle of the night and you pad out to maybe watch a little TV, you are almost guaranteed to come across something like this.
Change could start today in the dental assistant program at Kaplan College, but it's only going to happen if you make the call.
For-profit colleges promising career training and a better life. But critics of these schools say their students often leave with a lot of debt and not a whole lot to show for it. The Obama administration just released a bunch of new rules aimed at these colleges, and our education correspondent Amy Scott joins us from WYPR in Baltimore. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Tess.
So tell us a little bit about these new rules. What will these for-profit colleges have to do differently?
Well, starting next July, they'll have to disclose their graduation rates and job placement rates so students have a better sense of what they're getting for their money. They'll also no longer be able to pay their enrollment counselors or financial aid officers based on the number of students that they get to sign up.
Hmm.
There have been a lot of reports in the last year, including on Marketplace, of aggressive and sometimes deceptive tactics to get students enrolled in these schools. Here's one example we heard in an investigation with ProPublica last year. This is a former admissions counselor at the University of Phoenix named Brandon Burke.
One thing we would be told to do is call up a student who was on the fence and say, all right, I've only got one seat left. I need to know right now if you need me to save this for you. Well, that wasn't true.
Wow.
And there have been other accounts of students being misled about financial aid or whether their credits could transfer to other schools, their job prospects upon graduation. And so these new rules are meant to clean up some of those practices.
But I understand that the most controversial rule was put off for a while.
Right. This one is called the gainful employment rule because these career training programs are supposed to prepare students for gainful employment.
Right.
There was a proposed rule that programs could lose access to federal aid if too many of their graduates don't earn enough to pay off their loans. Now, the Department of Education got more than 90,000 comments from the public on that rule. And after some heavy lobbying by the industry, the department said it would spend a little more time finalizing it. It's now due out next year and will take effect in 2012.
So what does all this mean for the students?
The for-profit college industry warns that it will limit access to college. I talked to one graduate of a for-profit college, American Military University. John Duffy of Crewe, Virginia, worked full-time, and he says, you know, programs at community colleges and other state schools he looked at didn't really work for him.
With a online private college, I was able to go to school on my schedule, still work, still take care of my wife and children, all responsibilities, and still finish my degree. It just took me longer and of course, cost more money.
That degree cost Duffy about $23,000, all of it paid for with federal loans. But, you know, he says that's a choice that he should be allowed to make. And the industry is warning that a lot of programs could be forced to shut down as a result of the gainful employment rule. And the rules are already having an impact. The University of Phoenix and others are tightening enrollment standards even before the new rules kick in.
Well, Amy, let me ask you this. This gainful employment rule, why is that only being targeted at for-profit colleges? I mean, there are plenty of students out there from, you know, UCLA down the street to Harvard, where students are spending ungodly amounts of money on degrees, and they're not going to get jobs where they can easily pay that back.
This gainful employment rule only applies to for-profit colleges and so-called non-degree programs. So Harvard isn't going to offer something like that. But their real target is definitely these for-profit schools. And there are a few reasons for that. For one, you know, many of these schools make 80-90% of their revenue from federal student aid programs like the Pell Grant and various loan programs. And their students are much more likely to default on their loans. Uh-huh. So, you know, the taxpayer is under consideration here. Also, you know, career colleges advertise as just that. Their whole purpose is to prepare students for jobs. So that's why they're being held accountable if those jobs don't pay enough so that these students can afford their loans.
I guess with a traditional university or college, they're preparing you for life?
Well, you could say there may be some other reasons that people go to a more expensive college. But, you know, it's a good point, and Republicans in Congress have been saying, why aren't we paying more attention to traditional higher ed, too, and what those schools are delivering to their students? And, you know, with the change in power this election, we may see more scrutiny of all kinds of higher ed.
All right. Marketplace's Amy Scott, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Liz Weston is with us again to take your calls. And our final caller for the day is Aaron. He is in San Francisco. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. And you?
I'm well. We have it's a beautiful day up here today.
Are you a Giants fan?
I am this year.
That's an honest answer.
It is. So how do you catch the show there in San Fran?
I podcast.
Podcast. Excellent. What do you do?
I work for the community college out here, and I do educational audio production as well as web content management and support.
Audio production, that's something I know a little bit about.
Audition is my friend.
Adobe Audition, that's right. How'd you get into that?
I finished my MBA, and I managed a private detective agency for a number of years. And decided, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. Took a year off, went back to school. Because with an MBA, what else do you do but get more education? Went back to school, took some audio production classes. My second semester taking classes, they said, hey, we have a job for you.
Okay, well, I want to go back to this whole private detective thing. Why did you leave the business of Aaron PI?
Far too stressful.
Was it the divorce work or was it
insurance fraud?
Insurance fraud, okay.
Those, when you catch people, they're not real happy about it.
No, I would not imagine they would be.
Well, and some of them are organized and, you know, a little bit
threatening. Oh, my aching back. Oh, yeah. But here I am mowing my lawn.
Playing bricks in the backyard.
Well, so is audio engineering providing a decent living for you?
I'm doing okay, but I do have a question about my partner and I finally became domestic partners. And shortly after we did that, I said, you know, we should look at each other's credit.
Oh, wait a minute. You're supposed to do that beforehand.
Yeah, no. I wasn't able to pull it off beforehand.
And, all right. Fair enough.
Mine's great. I look at it every year. I know what's on it. He didn't know how to get his credit report and had never seen it.
Had never seen it. Wow. How old is he?
28.
So were there big surprises?
A couple. Yeah, he took out a student loan and never paid it.
How much is it?
It was originally $3,000.
Okay.
And then according to the credit report, it went up to about 14. And then when he would deposit money into his bank, the feds would take it out. So it's back down to about $3,000.
So did it actually go into default or did it not be? Oh, it did. Okay. Liz, I want to play a little clip here because we've had folks call up before and you've had advice for them on how to bring up the credit report situation. Let's take a listen to that.
the most unromantic date idea, but the most important. If you're serious about someone, honestly, sit down, go to annualcreditreport.com, pull your credit reports.
So, Aaron, how did you approach that with your partner?
Well, it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
And I could use some tips on how to continue to discuss it, because I'm wondering, like, how it's going to affect my credit score now that we're as married as we're allowed to be.
Uh-huh.
But also, if it's going to affect mine, should we make this a number one priority to deal with his?
Yeah. Well, let's take that first question. And, you know, we get versions of this quite a bit from people who are merging their finances and want to know if one half of the relationship's credit score, credit reports, will somehow damage the other half. And they don't,
no.
Right? I mean, these are one part of the relationship that are forever separate.
Yeah. Basically, nobody has a combined credit report.
Right.
You continue to have your own, whether you're married or not, whether your marriage is recognized in California or by the feds or whoever.
Right.
When you get combined information on that report is when you go in together on a loan. See, if the two of you tried to go get a mortgage right now, all of his problems would drag down the score that's going to be used to determine your rate. On the flip side, if you were to add him as an authorized user to a credit card, you have to talk to the credit card company and make sure that they'll export the information. But a lot of times that will help his credit history.
Oh.
You don't ever have to give him the actual plastic or let him use it, but adding him as an authorized user can help him build positive credit history to start offsetting the problems he's had in the past.
Yeah. Is that something that you might consider, putting him as an authorized user on one of your cards?
Yeah, I'll totally do that, like, later today.
Just to help him start getting rebuilt. And my husband is an artist, so we went through a lot of this. And, you know, what I learned was that I had to back off of it because I know all about money and I know what we should do, and that's obnoxious. What really helps is understanding what drew you to the person, what you love about them, and, you know, kind of incorporating their worldview and how you handle money.
Okay.
What about the conversation? I mean, Aaron has indicated that it's not an easy one, and as we all know, it never is. So, I mean, you've suggested actually having a date, you know, where you talk about money. Any other tips for getting that conversation started?
Because it's usually the person who's more responsible with money that's starting the conversation,
yeah.
I would come at it from a posture of real humility. You know, not, I know how we should do this, and this is how you should come into line. But, you know, open-ended questions. What do you see as, you know, our future goals? What would you like to be building towards? Those kind of things. You know, try to suspend the judgment and try to work on a compromise somewhere that you guys can meet in the middle.
Okay.
All right, Aaron, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. If you've got a question, do let us know about it. Send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Liz, thanks so much for sticking around.
My pleasure.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. There are signs of life in the job market. The Labor Department reported this week that the private sector added 159,000 jobs in October, though the unemployment rate remains stagnant at 9.6%. So the economy is still a pumpkin, and jobless Americans are still looking for that glass slipper. You remember who comes to the rescue now, right?
It's time to get America back to work.
Fairy Job Mother is a new reality show on the Lifetime channel and the latest television import from Britain. Hayley Taylor is the woman with the magic jobs wand. She takes eight families from across the country, households with someone who has been unemployed for at least 6 months, and tries to coach them out of their situation. Take a little family therapy.
What I want to deal with first is your relationship and the lack of communication in it.
Add practical tips for the job interview.
Please remember to say please.
And a dash of tough love.
The last job you applied for, when was it?
About 3 weeks ago.
Oh, God. That should have been 3 hours ago.
And you've got the Fairy Job Mother's secret potion. Hayley Taylor joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You say a couple of times in the first episode that you want to get to the bottom of why people can't find work. So I think people's first notion would be, well, it's because there aren't any jobs. What's beyond that?
I would say to that, there are jobs, but there are less jobs. These individual families in the 8 episodes that you will see are all suffering symptoms of low self-belief. They're totally dysfunctional within the family life. They're in debt. There are so many elements rolled into the effects of unemployment. And I want to get it out there. You know, it's very, very difficult for them to see a way forward.
And so you spend a day observing the family, and then you come back with your recommendations.
We've spoken a little bit about how you've lost a lot of confidence. You've got to have confidence to go into work, and you've also got to have confidence in the way that you look, the way that you dress.
You know, you talk a lot about self-confidence.
Yes.
You know, if you lack confidence, you can't find a job. But, you know, if you don't have a job, that may be a reason why you're not self-confident. It's a bit of a vicious cycle, isn't it?
What I would say is there is a difference between confidence and self-esteem. Mm. Self-esteem is how you feel on the inside about yourself, but confidence is what you portray on the outside. You know, inside now, I'm absolutely quavering because you're talking to me, but probably I look really, really confident.
It's just
confident.
Radio. It's not even television.
Yeah, but you know, it's nerves, and it's the same for anybody, no matter what they do.
Yeah.
You know, and you can fool someone into thinking you are a lot more confident than what you are. And that is what I always say to the people that I work with. You know, that outside first impression is absolutely fundamental.
It seems like even just the language that you're using today, and certainly the language you use in the show, you're almost a therapist to your clients.
You know, it's really strange because the one thing I'm not is a qualified counsellor. Although I studied psychology and obviously communication skills, you pick so much up by working with people day in, day out. Plus, they say to me, you know, you're our last resort. You're the last hope. And when someone is pinning that on you, you have got to do everything in your power to move them on. And that is what I do within Fairy Job Mother.
You went through something pretty similar in your life. I know your husband was laid off. How much
That's
of that
right.
experience informs how you're now working with jobless folks?
Do you know, I would say probably 20% is my qualifications and years of experience working with the unemployed. The rest of it is life skills.
Hmm.
I mean, my husband had been in a job for 10 years and then he found himself redundant. At that time, our daughter was 1 year old.
Hmm.
I was obviously a stay-at-home mum with her at that point and we had no money coming in. And then he became a victim when he did get back to work of underemployment, where he had to go and do a far, far less skilled job. And that is what you do. And that's why I think I can relate so much.
What about, you know, the stigma that I think a lot of people face when they've been unemployed for weeks and months on end?
Yes.
What's the best way for them to deal with that and kind of pick up and keep that job search going?
What I would say is to forget about that stigma, because there are so many people out there in the same boat and they just need that break. And I think that if every employer out there would just give people a chance by letting them work possibly for a week unpaid and considering giving them a reference if they do a good job, then that would go a long way to dispelling the stigma that's attached.
Haley Taylor is the Fairy Job Mother on a new series on Lifetime. It's been awfully fun talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Reality TV isn't the only cultural signpost for this era of unemployment. Have you seen the new comic book, The Adventures of Unemployed Man and his sidekick, Plan B? They do daily battle with classic villains, including The Man and Human Resources. We came up with a few recession-inspired superheroes ourselves. Pink Slip, superheroine who wages war on unjust layoffs. Staycationer, who fights crime on vacation and without ever leaving the house. We want your suggestions. Go to our website or post on our Facebook page. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, teaching kids early on how to manage their money. And I mean early.
Get in the habit.
Get in the habit.
Like Sammy Rabbit.
Like Sammy Rabbit.
Saving money.
Saving money.
All the time.
All the time.
Kids equals radio gold. All the time. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering advisors and clients a range of retirement savings solutions. Is a Roth IRA conversion right for you? You can talk to your advisor and evaluate your options at RothIRAblog.com.
American Public Media.